This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2002, Volume 22, Number 10. In this month's issue, our topic will be the Clinical Laboratory in Functional Medicine. Our reports will cover the objectives of the Functional Medicine Laboratory, the puzzle of complex diseases, oxidant stress risk factors, and complex functional disorders including autism and cancer. Our interviews this month will be with representatives of three functional medicine laboratories. From Great Smokies, Dr. Brad Rackman. From Metametrics, Dr. Alexander Brawley. And from Doctors Data, Mr. Daryl Hickok. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the October 2002 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
This issue we're going to focus on the use of the clinical laboratory in functional medicine, a topic that we have not fully dedicated any single edition of Functional Medicine Update over the last 20 years to, but a very important topic and one that I think is timely as it relates to the better application of functional medicine concepts in the clinic. What are the objectives that we're trying to achieve with the use of the clinical laboratory? Obviously, to better understand the underlying mechanisms, etiology, pathogenesis, and ultimately sequence of events that relate to a specific illness. In the past, the medical model with regard to the use of the clinical laboratory was fairly simplistic, and that is we look for the markers of end-organ pathology that would then be seen in a specific biological specimen or fluid, for which then their level of this specific analyte would be indicative of that tissue having undergone some kind of a necrotic or apoptotic cell death. For instance, with liver injury, as is seen in hepatitis or cirrhosis, we would look for elevations of specific enzymes that were markers of liver cell function, hepatocyte function, like the transaminases, where the liver is very heavily responsible for manipulating an amino acid one to the other through transamination and deamination. Therefore, there is a very high level of activity of these transaminases in the liver cell. And when the liver cell dies and releases its contents into the plasma, we can then use this surrogate marker, that is, high levels of transaminase enzymes in the plasma, as an indication of the degree of liver death. When we talk about liver cell death or heart cell death or muscle cell death, the pathological evaluation then is to look for specific markers that are indicative of that cell having undergone premature injury or death. This is a very tidy way of using the laboratory to diagnose a disease as if the disease was caused by a specific injurious factor that led to a whole organism or whole organ effect, which is injury and death of that cell. Well before this, however, in the sequel of events that ultimately leads to tissue pathology, are below the scenes many variables that relate to altered cellular function that ultimately then lead to cell death. It is these precedent factors, the functional changes in cells, as a consequence of a different expression of gene patterns and proteomic outcome, that leads to a functional medicine request for understanding. The functionality of the cell, therefore, is related more to the precedent steps that alter the expression patterns of gene activation, and ultimately then are seen as a different cellular physiology, the cellular physiology that ultimately leads to premature cell death. Well, I don't know if you understand the difference, so let me give you an example that might typify this. At the turn of the last century, a major medical advance was made that guided much of the development of medicine, and that was the concept of a infectious disease caused by an infectious organism. And the model of disease at that point was reasonably easy to understand. A single agent, i.e. an organism such as pneumococcus, produces a single disease, i.e. pneumonia, for which later than it was discovered, a single molecule could treat it. So the medical model was very simple. Single agent produces a single disease for which a single molecule, i.e. pharmaceutical, is used to treat it. Now, if medicine was to have stayed that simple over the last 100-plus years, it wouldn't take advanced schooling to get a medical degree. In fact, you could memorize a fairly comprehensive list of single agents causing single disease for which single molecules treat it, and you could be one of the most successful physicians that the world has ever known. The difficulty, however, is that the diseases that have developed to be the most predominant disorders in an aging Western population are not so simple as single agent produces a single disease for which a single molecule treats it, but rather complex diseases of multigenes in which the genetic propensity or susceptibility factors interact with a complex environment to give rise to a phenotype that is called disease. As example, coronary heart disease, cancer, maturity onset diabetes, osteoarthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, certain behavioral abnormalities, psychiatric disorders, neurodegenerative disorders, all are reflective of this new model, multigenes impacted by environmental factors giving rise to altered phenotype. This new model is much more complex to understand, and rather than look for the single indicator of a disease, like an elevated liver enzyme to indicate liver injury, such as hepatitis or cirrhosis, what we're really looking at are the mechanisms that give rise to altered cellular function that ultimately lead to dysfunction that we later call disease. That is the functional medicine model. The clinical laboratory was not well established in its early stages to really answer these questions, and therefore many people use the standard blood screens, the so-called SMA or comprehensive screening systems, to try to evaluate functionality. These screens, however, were set up really to evaluate pathology. And so if you took blood glucose levels, BUN to creatinine levels, serum AG ratios, albumin to globulin ratios, you looked at SGOT, SGPT, CPK, you looked at other analytes related to calcium or phosphorus, sodium or potassium, these would lead you to not an understanding so much as the function of the cell, but as to its pathological state. Now, some of those analytes were more related to functionality than others. One that was added to the panel later was cholesterol, for which there is not a single disease that we can say is associated with cholesterol as an analyte. Rather, it's a prognostic factor that relates to risk for a variety of vascular disorders. So the addition of cholesterol, then later the subtypes of apolipoproteins of cholesterol, like HDL, gave rise to a new way of utilizing the blood screen or the blood pathology screen, and that was to evaluate relative risk rather than just existing pathology. I'm sure you recognize that there is no single disease that we can say is a cholesterol disease. Rather, cholesterol HDL ratios are used as prognostic evaluative risk factors for later stage vascular disorders. So with that in mind, we've extended then the concept of the use of the clinical laboratory from that of pathology-focused to that of prognostic or risk factor-focused analysis. Moving from that, then, is the discussion of the use of the clinical laboratory in evaluating functionality at the cell physiological level, and even deeper than that is the function as it relates to genetic expression from the pluripotentiality of the genome into its protein constituents through proteomics and ultimately into the functional capability of the cell as its phenotype. Therefore, depending upon what you want to ask, the clinical laboratory can be used in many ways. Traditionally, because we have focused almost exclusively on diagnosis as a prima facie requirement of doing good medicine, it's the sine qua non is to come up with a good diagnosis, we have focused the clinical laboratory on the assistance in helping us to make a clean diagnosis from a pathological perspective. So we look at such things as antinuclear antibodies for the presence of various autoimmune disorders, or prothrombin time to look at coagulation or sedimentation effects that relate to blood coagulation parameters. Or we look at such things as various markers in electrolytes, the potassium and sodium levels, to look at adrenal function, looking for endocrinopathies or specific pathologies of the endocrine system. In a sense, however, we now recognize that in an aging population whose declining function is associated with chronic disease, the major challenge to medicine is managing these chronic disease clusters rather than just waiting until a clean diagnosis results, for which very expensive hospitalization, surgery, and other costly interventions are required. And that is the birth, obviously, of the use of the clinical laboratory in assessing function in a functional medicine perspective. So this new model, which is genetic multiplicity, or what are called nucleotide polymorphisms, gives rise to different interaction with a complex environment to give rise to different kinds of disorders that later become diseases in their entity. And it's understanding this kind of sequence of events and the mixture of environmental factors with genetic uniqueness that gives rise to this new field of personalized medicine. Now, this theme is very nicely described in a recent issue of Science Magazine, the title of which on the cover was The Puzzle of Complex Diseases. This was the April 26 issue, 2002, volume 296 of Science. And in the introductory editorial to this particular series of articles, the title is It's Not Just the Genes. And in this particular editorial, the author points out that it's genetic susceptibility or genetic uniqueness coupled with environmental exposures, environmental factors, which include toxins and trauma and environmental effects and radiation and psychosocial variables, including distress, allergies, chronic infections. All of these various exposures to genes then give rise to different expression patterns that then translate into different physiological phenotypes at the cellular level. And it's the laboratory's emerging responsibility to understand how this complex interaction ultimately translates itself into later stage disease. In fact, an article that appeared within this Science Magazine issue entitled Maneuvering in the Complex Path from Genotype to Phenotype talks about the human disease as a phenotype. It's the end stage of a series of events. They're controlled not only by genes, but by this self-organizing network that displays system-wide dynamics. These networks, which we see as metabolic pathways, respond to signaling events that occur at the cellular levels. The signaling events are an interaction then of the environment with the genes to then signal at a distance to cells and tissues and organs at a distance that there are different responses of the body to that effect. Study then of the dynamics of these networks of approaches have led to metabolic control analysis, which people are now using to look at new insights into the pathogenesis and treatment of complex disorders that we call chronic illness, which may not be amenable to a very clean diagnosis. And how many times have you had that happen in your experience, in which a patient comes in, they have a whole array of symptoms, from headaches to digestive problems to chronic fatigue to muscle body pain like myalgias to joint space pain to cognitive dysfunction, inability to concentrate, sleep disturbances, and trying to find one single clean diagnosis for this complex array of symptoms is virtually impossible. It's because their phenotypes are reflective of a reaction of the genes to the environment in such a way as to create these complex signals that really are related to a metabolic dysfunction or metabolic loss of control or a different state function of their metabolism, which is a state function of chronic illness. I think this concept of a metabolic control analysis, looking at the metabolome, this complex series of events that we see in metabolism that really arose from the proteome, the enzymes and proteins that control metabolism, and then how that relates to the genome, is this new field of genomics, proteomics, and metabolomics, the so-called omics revolution that we're now involved with. This is a whole new use of the clinical laboratory to evaluate functional genomics, functional proteomics, and then functional metabolomics to understand the trajectory and the tendency towards specific diseases who along the way are producing complex symptoms of dysfunction, which are then causing a use of medical services which may be unnecessary if we understand the origin of these conditions. Now let's talk about one of these examples, just to take it from the philosophical to the real. And that's the example that we've heard about in Functional Medicine Update on previous editions, which is the folate and vitamin B12 and homocysteine story that's emerging around the genetic polymorphisms of the folate cycle enzymes. One of these enzymes that we focused on, which shows a lot of genetic polymorphism and high penetrance, meaning high prevalence, is the enzyme called methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, abbreviated MTHFR. Methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase is one of a number of steps that are involved in the folate cycle and the homocysteine cycle. It's involved principally in setting in motion the transmethylation process that results in the transfer of methyl groups so as to produce complex phospholipids for the nervous system and for cellular membranes, for steroid hormone manipulation, neurotransmitter detoxification and metabolism. It is a very important general one-carbon metabolic pathway as well as clearing, obviously, homocysteine. As we said in the previous editions of Functional Medicine Update, between 20 and 30% of the population has been found to have, in America, polymorphisms, or so-called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, of the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene. One of these that has a very high commonality is a polymorphism that substitutes a cytosine for a thymidine at residue 677, 677 on the nucleotide chain of that gene, that code for that particular enzyme, that messenger RNA that codes for that enzyme. This particular C677T polymorphism of methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase can exist in one of two forms, and it can exist in the wild type form, which is the normal type that the most of the population has, and then it can exist in these polymorphic forms that can be either monozygotic or dizygotic, meaning they can be either single allele coming from only one parent or double allele coming from both parents. If they come from both parents, we might call that a recessive homozygous characteristic, but you get a double bang from the buck, so to speak, and that individual has expressed patterns of the MTHFR C677T much more commonly than if they have the heterozygous, meaning they only get one half of their double alleles as the polymorphic gene. So you have variations on a theme. You have the wild type, and then you have the fully fledged homozygous type with both alleles, mother and father's contribution showing 677T, and then you have the halfway point, 50%, showing 677 and the other half not. What this means is you get different variations in output into the phenotype with regard to how an individual can metabolize folic acid and transfer methyl groups into the homocysteine pathway to make S-adenosylmethionine, which is ultimately the principal methyl donor. That's SAM, S-A-M, S-adenosylmethionine. And we recognize that defects in this particular pathway can have multiple effects on differing diseases. The list, as you've heard it listed in previous editions, is quite long, including not just heart disease and stroke, but also risk to breast cancer, risk to endometrial cancer, possibly risk to prostatic cancer, depression, various disorders related to neurodegenerative diseases, maybe even Alzheimer's as well, and certainly conditions related to various epithelial malignancies, including colon cancer, cervical cancer, and possibly lung cancer. So we're seeing that this methylation story plays across many, many different disorders that have single diagnosis, but for which the mechanism may cut across many diseases. And it may relate in part back not just to MTHFR polymorphisms, but to that polymorphism in combination with others. Remember, multigenes along with multiple environmental factors to give complex disorders. That's the new emerging view of disease, at least the common kinds of chronic degenerative disease that we find with age-related dysfunctions. So this recent paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, entitled Methylene Tetrahydrofolate Reductase, a Link Between Folate and Riboflavin, talks about the fact that this enzyme process that's associated with methyl donation through the MTHFR enzyme is dependent also on a flavin antininucleotide, or FAD, and that is derived from riboflavin by vitamin B2. And therefore, there is a strong correlation between MTHFR polymorphisms, not only folic acid status, but also riboflavin status. And so certain derivatives of folic acid, like 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, one of the derivatives of folic acid, which works downstream from this enzyme polymorphism, may be a preferable form of folic acid in certain individuals as long as they're also considering adequacy for other nutrients involved with this cycle, including vitamin B12, vitamin B6, and we add riboflavin vitamin B2 to that list. So it's a very interesting reminder that these processes do not work in isolation one at a time, that there is a symphonic connection, a web of interaction among these single gene polymorphisms and other characteristics that then form a pattern. And it's that pattern recognition, which is called informatics. Medical informatics is really trying to understand these patterns, these clusters that associate themselves with specific disease risks. So it's not just looking for the gene that causes heart disease or the gene that causes diabetes or the gene that causes Alzheimer's. Rather, it's looking for the characteristic pattern at the genomic, proteomic, and metabolomic levels that gives rise to the relative risk or susceptibility factors to those disorders. With regard to MTHFR specifically, what we're learning is it's more than just folic acid or 5-methyltetrahydrofolate or 5-4-methyltetrahydrofolate. It's also riboflavin. It's also vitamin B12. It's also vitamin B6. And it's also betaine or other methyl donors in the diet. A very interesting example of that, again, I might cite this paper. The title of the paper looks a little esoteric. It's impaired functioning of thermolabile methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase is dependent on riboflavin status and the implication, therefore, for riboflavin requirements. This, again, is the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 76, page 436 in 2002. Again, emphasizing the connection. So if we were to look at the clinical laboratory in functional medicine, we would want to know what is the MTHFR genotype, because that might relate to cardiovascular risk or stroke risk or dementia risk or depression risk. And we would then want to look in therapy not just at a single nutrient, folic acid, but the forms of folic acid, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, and the other companion complex nutrients such as riboflavin, pyridoxine, and cobalamin, vitamin B12, that work together to arrive at improved function in that metabolic series of events, the so-called metabolome, which controls the phenotype. Let's take another example. Let's look at the oxidant stress example. This is another very interesting place where I know there is considerable interest and controversy. How do you measure oxidative stress, and if you could, what value would it have in clinical management? If you look at a strict pathology textbook and examine the clinical laboratory from a pathological perspective, there is no test on our standard blood screens that measure directly tissue oxidative injury. It is rather a functional state of the system that gives rise to the risk to a variety of phenotypes that we would call different diseases. So from a strict pathological perspective, we might say this is uninteresting. From a functional perspective that understands the chronic complex origin of disease and the symptoms that arise from it, oxidative analysis may be very important. And therefore, examining something related to the redox of the cell, the reduction oxidation capability of the cell, is really possibly a cornerstone in understanding more about the metabolome and the functional status of that patient. Now, how do you do that? Well, we recognize there are many ways of evaluating oxidative states of cellular systems, one of which is to look at the injury that has occurred to the system. For instance, looking at oxidized lipids, the so-called thiobarbituric acid test or lipid peroxide test measures the debris, the embers, so to speak, that occur as a consequence of the oxidative injury that's occurred to fatty acids. This releases malonaldehyde, which then reacts with a dye in the laboratory test to give rise to a colorant, which can be measured then fluorometrically or colorimetrically, and to quantitate against the standard then the degree of lipid peroxidation. And we use this in food chemistry for evaluating the amount of rancid oils in food, and we can look at biological rancidification within our own blood as examples of lipid peroxidation. So this is a downstream marker for injury caused by peroxidation, extracellularly, because you're normally measuring peroxides either in plasma or in urine. Another way of examining injury is by using an intracellular test for oxidative injury of DNA. This is a test that we've described in previous editions of FMU called the 8-deoxyguanosine test, or 8-OHDG. 8-OHDG, 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, is a measurement of the amount of DNA that has been damaged by peroxidative or oxidative injury. And this is an intracellular test, normally using lymphocytic DNA to evaluate then the amount of intracellular oxidative damage that's occurred. About 50% of the 8-OHDG levels that are measured in the blood have occurred as a consequence of what's going on in the nervous system, according to more recent studies. And therefore, what we're looking at are those high oxygen exposed tissues and organs of the body that have been undergoing DNA damage and presumably other damage to other proteins or lipids. We can look at protein carbonyls as a measurement of protein oxidation, or we can look at, obviously, the damaged lipids by lipid peroxidation to look at lipid injury. So DNA damage by 8-OHDG intracellularly. Now let's examine how we would evaluate oxidative status without looking at what's damaged, but at the state of redox, the reduction oxidation quotient. There are a number of tests that are used to do this, which have the ability to look at how resistive the cell matrix is to an oxidative stress. In other words, you add a specific oxidative stress factor like a T-butyl hydroperoxide to a blood sample and examine how the sample can resist that oxidative stress. This is a test like ORAC, O-R-A-C, the oxygen-reducing absorbance capacity that actually measures the resistance of a cellular matrix or a plasma to an oxidative stressful event. Presumably, we're looking at antioxidant reserve in this particular capability, or redox buffering, as I'll call it, because our reduction oxidation can be buffered just as our pH can be buffered or our electrolytes can be buffered by the presence of adequate redox active substances within the cell or the extracellular matrix. So there are many ways of examining either the tendency towards oxidative reductive injury or the presence of oxidative reductive injury. Now the question is, who cares? So we can measure it. Why do we really care? Well, let me give you one example why we might care. It's known that individuals who go on to have major vascular events or major pulmonary events or major inflammatory events have elevated levels of lipid peroxides, elevated levels of 8-OHDG, and other markers of cellular injury as a consequence of oxidative events. And therefore, if we want to look at a tendency towards an imbalance of redox that's associated with these tissue pathologies, we might be wanting to measure these oxidized LDLs, oxidized lipids, oxidized DNA to see what the state of affairs relative to redox is in the cells. Now, one such study that has evaluated this clinically is to look at the effects of a soy food containing individuals' blood lipids. And this is a very interesting study, I believe, because what they did is they intervened with soy foods that were found to be high in isoflavones and those that were low in isoflavones, like genistein and daidzine, that are known to have effects on hormone regulation and antioxidant redox status. So by taking individuals and randomizing them into either a high or a low isoflavone soy food diet, they could then examine their blood lipids, their oxidized LDL, their lipid peroxides, their homocysteine, and their blood pressure to examine what role differing dietary interventions had on the expression patterns in genes in average people that gave rise to either increased or reduced risk to, in this case, obviously, vascular disease. And lo and behold, they found in this study that when individuals consumed the high isoflavone-containing diet, and this was about 73 milligrams of total isoflavones daily, and they did this by substituting their soy foods for animal foods, that it reduced all of these cardiovascular risk factors as contrasted to the low isoflavone, which was about 10 milligrams of isoflavones daily. That would be a very low level. So the 73 milligram per day isoflavone diet, that was in 50 grams of soy protein per day, resulted in a lowering of oxidized LDL, a lowering of lipid peroxidation as a measurement of oxidative stress, a lowering of total homocysteine, and lowering of blood pressure, as well as a lowering of total cholesterol. So here is an example where we use a test to evaluate functional changes that have occurred as a consequence of a dietary intervention, showing that one can manipulate functionality with specific dietary intervention. By the way, again, this is the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 76, page 365 in 2002. Here are two interesting examples of the use of the functional laboratory trying to understand the trajectory towards disease and contributions that may be associated to chronic symptoms in these complex disease patterns. Let me take a third example that might help us to understand this as well, and that's in the area of detoxification or biotransformation. As you undoubtedly recognize, it's now being found that there are many specific nutrients found in individual foods that we'll call these phytonutrients, P-H-Y-T-O, or plant-derived nutrients, that influence the expression patterns of the genes that are associated with phase 1 and phase 2 detoxification. That would be the phase 1 mixed function oxidase enzymes, or the cytochrome P450s, or CYPs as they're often abbreviated, CYPs, and the phase 2 conjugation enzymes. It has to do with glucuronidation, sulfation, methylation, glutathione conjugation, and amino acid conjugation. These particular pathways have to be in balance in order to properly detoxify endogenous and exogenous substances so they can be eliminated either through the bile or the urine effectively. And we now recognize that specific nutrients found in specific foods can influence expression patterns of both the phase 1 and phase 2 enzymes. Well, one of the interesting examples of this has to do with the use of various cruciferous vegetables to upregulate phase 2 detoxification enzymes and to produce what is called bifunctional modulation of detoxification. Bifunctional modulation means to lower the activity of an upregulated or an overly activated phase 1, because overly activated phase 1 enzymes, cytochrome P450s, can produce too much of what are called biotransformed intermediates, which may be more hazardous than the substances from which they were derived. These intermediates, the biotransformed intermediates that come through upregulation of specific isoforms of cytochrome P450, may in fact have more injurious effects upon cells than the substances from which the body was detoxifying. So that then has to be, that biotransformed intermediate has to be detoxified by a phase 2 compatible step to form a balanced process of phase 1 and phase 2, delivering this as a system through the phase 1 and phase 2 transformational steps. And bifunctional modulators are specific phytonutrients that have been discovered to facilitate that balance. They will lower the excessive activation of specific phase 1 enzymes while upregulating the expression of the requisite phase 2 detoxification enzyme, so that you end up in improving detoxification and improving the balance so as to lower the levels of steady state concentration of the potentially injurious biotransformed intermediates. This is a very interesting concept when you think about it. It's if Mother Nature had infinite wisdom and could put in foods specific phytonutrients that would then interact with our genes in such a way as to regulate symphonically the production of the proteins that control detoxification. And in doing so, help to lead to a safe response by lowering the upregulation of phase 1 and facilitating the proper regulation of phase 2. Well, one of the many substances that has been discovered to do this are the glucosinolates found in watercress and gardencress, which are now known to improve in animal studies detoxification of very serious carcinogens and to lower then the potential risk for formation of neoplastic lesions in these animals when they consume higher levels of these glucosinolates found in the gardencress or watercress. I'm now quoting an article from Carcinogenesis, Volume 23, page 1155 in 2002. Now, why am I speaking to this? Because it's not just watercress glucosinolates. It's a whole range of different phytonutrients that influence the expression patterns as bifunctional modulators. The reason I'm really saying this is that one of the things that clinical laboratories can now do from a functional medicine perspective is to evaluate genetic uniqueness of the phase 1 enzyme system and genetic uniqueness of the phase 2 detoxification enzyme. So you can look at those individuals that may be upregulated in their phase 1s or may be downregulated in their phase 2s, in which there is an imbalance that has been produced and they have what's called imbalanced detoxification status. The use of the laboratory will help us to measure these pharmacogenomic relationships of the individual to their environment. This, again, gets us beyond one size fits all, just assuming that no matter what you give a person, they're going to have the same response. We know that's certainly not true from pharmaceutical compounds. We also recognize it's not true from environmental exposures. Different uniquenesses to detoxification based upon genetic and nutritional intervention or interrelationships. So here's another place where the functional medicine laboratory can be of very significant value in understanding these pharmacogenetic or pharmacogenomic relationships of the detox profiles to various exposures. And then by intervening with specific nutrients that are known to help perform bifunctional modulation capability, you can then design a program individualized to that patient to minimize their risk or to improve their first-pass detoxification of specific substances. Another, I think, fascinating application of the clinical laboratory in functional medicine. Now, as we move beyond that, there are a variety of complex disorders which have received considerable attention recently as to how they would be evaluated from a clinical laboratory perspective. One of these is autistic spectrum disorders. As you probably recognize, there is a ever-increasing recognition that autism is, again, another condition associated with interface or interaction between genes and environment. And I was very, very pleased to see a series of papers that were submitted to The Lancet recently talking about Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his, what I think, seminal paper looking at ileal nodular hyperplasia as associated with autism and the connection of that to MMR vaccinations, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination. As you know, he's received a tremendous amount of criticism and has been tempted to be defrocked as a pediatric gastroenterologist of academic stature. But I think his data, as provocative as it is, continues to stand as a very important point in our understanding of these complex disorders. It's not that every child with autism had an adverse response to their immunization. It's just to remind us that there are unique genetic responses that we may have that associate themselves through the lymphatic and the immune system that ultimately then create different phenotypic outcome in expression patterns. Remember that the gut, the liver, and the white cells in the brain, glia, are all interconnected through similar signaling systems. Again, those of you that want to read about the autism bowel inflammation measles connection, you might want to look at the Lancet volume 359, page 2112, 2002, for a very nice discussion about MMR vaccinations, ileal nodular hyperplasia, to see where the debate lies and the differing sides of this debate. Again, I'm very cautious not to take a side in this debate, but rather to say I think Dr. Wakefield's contribution opens our eyes to the complex nature of a disorder like autism spectrum disorders. By the way, there's a wonderful review paper that has been written by Dr. Bernard Rindelman and Dr. Woody McGinnis entitled Vaccines and Autism that reviews this in very great detail. The review article, I think, is a scholarly work of significant magnitude. There are in excess of 150 references at the back of this review article, and you can receive a reprint of this article, Vaccines and Autism, from the Autism Research Institute, 4182 Adams Avenue, San Diego, California, 92116. And that will be available, that address, on the summary cards from the end of this month's system. Now, I should mention to you that autism spectrum disorders, the gut-brain connection, then leads us into trying to understand from the clinical laboratory perspective where the specific problem may lie in that child, knowing that differing effects may be seen in different children. This then is, again, looking for patterns, recognizing patterns of specific metabolites within the metabolome that may reflect different proteomic and genomic expression patterns that then are modifiable through intervention with specific dietary programs, detoxification programs, complex psychosocial support programs, in other words, an integrated approach that will give that child optimal opportunity for addressing possible underlying immunological problems, toxicity problems, and metabolic problems. So this is a different approach than just a diagnosis and then the management of symptoms. We're really looking at trying to determine the underlying cause. Now, the same theme holds true, obviously, with malignancy. And as you probably know, cancer is a huge disorder of major proportion, the origin of which is still emerging. I was very fascinated to see in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute recently a review paper that was quite well written discussing the prevalence of cancers in males from 1950 to 1998 and the relationship of its prevalence to various socioeconomic patterns, finding that in the past it was people of higher socioeconomic patterns that had the higher incidence of cancer. This is 1950. But in 1998, it was individuals of lower socioeconomic status that had higher incidence of cancer, suggesting that people who are more well-informed and more able to afford different kinds of foods and environmental quality were able to mobilize some of this information and lower their incidence of cancer over the past 40 years, whereas those individuals less able, less flexible to introduce and implement these concepts continue to have increasing cancer incidence. So is cancer a modifiable condition by genes and environment? I think the answer is screaming through yes, unequivocally yes. And therefore, genomic patterning, proteomics, and metabolomics become part of the assessment of cancer risk as well. So the cancer risk analysis has moved us into a whole range of new medical informatics, trying to do pattern recognition and cluster analysis to determine what specific analytes would be most useful in defining relative risk that patient has or the trajectory towards cancer or towards proper treatment. And that leads us into cancer diagnostics, tumor marker analysis, and these complex gene arrays in which maybe thousands of genes would be evaluated in their expression patterns to see which were being expressed that might lead to malignancy. We're not yet there where this has emerged as an adult, fully mature field, but certainly the early stages indicates that we are heading in the right direction. A wonderful review paper appeared in Clinical Chemistry in a recent issue, which I found fascinating, volume 48, page 1145 in 2002, looking at cancer diagnostics from the tumor marker proteomic genomic perspective. And in this particular review, in which they go on to talk about cancer markers are easier said than done, they talk to the theory that as we get a large enough array of genes that are being evaluated and their protein outcome using specific density gradient methods or gel electrophoresis or other yet-to-be-identified technologies, that we'll be able to ultimately throw enough of a blanket or a net over all of these genes that will start to tease out specific clusters that give rise to specific cancer incidences or risks. And I think this will lead to early warning diagnosis well before you get to a palpable tumor or even a radio-opaque image on a scan, and will give us then the ability to start to do early intervention where, in fact, it may be much easier to avert the progression of cancer than at the later stage. And when I say early, I mean at the single or very early stage in cellular replication, single cell or 100 cells, not 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 cells. So it's a very, very exciting time using this new technology for assessing these metabolic shifts in the phenotype that occur as a consequence of the interaction of the genes in the environment. We know that one of the markers that is emerging to be important will have to do with inflammation, because the metastatic process, the angiogenic process associated with tumor replication is associated with increased inflammatory response, and that's why anti-inflammatories are now being seen to be possibly important as tumor prevention or chemotherapeutic agents. I was fascinated to see a couple of papers that appeared in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute recently that talked about cyclooxygenase 2 in cancer, a power player that's defining the roles. This particular review, I should probably give you the reference, is volume 94, page 545 in 2002, describes the fact that this enzyme, the isoform of cyclooxygenase, the 2 form, the inducible form, which we've heard so much about recently as it relates to inflammatory disorders like osteoarthritis, is also principally important because it's upregulated in the inflammation associated with tumor metastasis and angiogenesis, and therefore selective COX2 inhibitors may play a very important role in downregulating the expression of this inducible enzyme and reducing then the inflammatory process associated with metastatic proliferation. I think this is a very, very interesting chapter in our emerging understanding of the web of variables, of physiological variables that associate with a specific disease. There has been a tendency in the past to think the pathophysiology of a disease to be of single entity. Now we're starting to see, obviously, a web of interacting physiological variables from multi-gene expression patterns. So what do we know about the diet in COX2? It's very interesting because it is being found that there are many dietary substances which are natural in occurrence and have natural COX2 selective inhibitory effects. Many of these are found in foods that have been for years associated with their, quote, anti-cancer influence, including things such as spices such as turmeric or curcuminoid-containing Indian spices. Rosemary has selective COX2 inhibitors, again, a spice that's been used historically in Ayurvedic medicine for its anti-tumor effects. We see a variety of soy isoflavones having some similar effects. So what we're starting to witness is alteration of some of these processes that are associated with inflammation that not disconnect to inflammatory arthritis, but also connect to heart disease and connect to metastatic disorders and malignancy. This is, again, indicating the important role that the clinical laboratory can have in understanding specific mechanisms of disease that cut across the individual diseases themselves. Understanding something about mechanisms and underlying pathophysiology at the cellular level, maybe even the genomic, proteomic, and metabolomic level, may be more important in improving cost effectiveness and having a more effective chronic disease management program than designing new drugs to manage just the symptoms on the downside. I think we have gone a long way with the model of one agent produces one disease to lead to one molecule for treatment to a new model which is to look at genetic polymorphisms and susceptibility translated into the proteomic outcome through environmental exposures, and then into a metabolic control system, which then we see in the phenotype. This is an exciting time for the use of the clinical laboratory in improving the precision and effectiveness of functional medicine. That concludes our introduction to this month's edition. Let's move to side two.
In our 20-year history of Functional Medicine Update, we've never had the fortune of pulling together an issue that's fully dedicated to evaluating the clinical laboratory in functional medicine and what tools it brings to the answering of complex questions. And to that end, we're very fortunate this issue to have three representatives of major laboratories in our space that really are providing services to the functional medicine practitioner. The first of which is Dr. Brad Rackman, who is a Vice President of Clinical Innovation and Marketing at Great Smokies Diagnostic Laboratory. And as most of you know, Great Smokies has taken a leadership position in predictive genomics. So it is to that end I'd like to ask you, Dr. Rackman, if you could kind of give us a sense as to how you see predictive genomics relating to functional medicine and opening up some new doors for the physician in managing the complex patient.
Well, Jeff, you've really been quite a bit of an educational provocateur in this area. I can remember 6 or 7 years ago, you introducing many of us to the concepts of genomics as a potential predictor of risk, and that the novel concept was introduced at that time that perhaps not all genes determined direct fate, but rather gave us a preponderance towards a situation and a potential roadmap with which we can change the expression of a patient's health. Yet with all of that great information and a new paradigm, the tools did not quite exist at that point in time for doctors to implement into clinical practice the concepts that you were sharing. And Great Smokies has been really fortunate to have a phenomenal brain trust that acted upon the huge database of information that's come out from the Human Genome Project in creating usable clinical panels of SNPs that have been selected upon by 4 major criteria. The SNPs are relevant to a particular clinical presentation like cardiovascular risk or osteoporosis risk or immunologic risk of up or down regulation or detoxification risk. They are certainly prevalent, which means there's some degree of certainty that these are going to show up in a typical patient population in a prevalence anywhere from a few percent upwards of 30 or 40%. They're modifiable, a key factor that the literature has demonstrated some ability to modify either directly the pathway by which the protein's expression is being changed or to provide some alternative pathway. And lastly, they're measurable, that we actually would have some phenotypic testing in the industry somewhere and as tools available to doctors by which they could measure whether the changes that they were recommending to their patients and their patients were ultimately implementing were indeed changing the expression of that gene and, most importantly, bringing a patient closer to health.
So if I can just review, this information is obviously very familiar to you and probably less familiar to many of our listeners. So you've talked about the single nucleotide polymorphisms that relate to specific criteria of disease risk. They have to be understood and measurable. They have to be modifiable through some kind of an intervention program. They have to have a reasonable prevalence, you said 2 to 3% or greater, and there has to be some way of evaluating in the phenotype of the individual or in their performance or function the outcome of those expression patterns. Is that a recap summary of what you just said?
You said it much better than I did.
And as it relates to this particular approach, which I think is extraordinarily innovative and really matches beautifully what we've been speaking to for so many years, you've chosen certain panels in the area of osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease risk, immunological, and the detoxic genomic approach. Why did you select those? What were the unique features of those gene panels that gave rise to those being the first entrees into the field?
As our initial research led us in the direction of looking at those SNPs via those 4 specific criteria, it was clear that the literature had developed a greater comfort around those 4 areas in being able to provide matches for all those 4 criteria than in many others. And the intent of our Genovations Development Group is certainly not to stop with those 4. We've embarked on a release by the end of our year having an additional 6 or 7 panels in key areas. These were the low-hanging fruit, though.
And when you look at each one of those, probably a molecular geneticist would say, well, gee whiz, there are a whole series of genes that are related to bone formation and bone loss, and a whole series of genes related to cardiovascular disease. And they might say, this is a yet fully to be explored treasure trove of information. How did you select the genes of choice, and what numbers is a broad enough blanket to throw across these so that you feel comfortable in doing this predictive genomic evaluation?
It's a really good point to discuss. I'm fully aware, and painfully aware is the research team, that there's so much more data to mine out of the Human Genome Project than we've been able to encapsulate into these individual profiles. What we've done is place a stake in the sand, if you will, and grab those profiles that have the most or substantial literature behind them relative to their impact for long-term health in those key areas of physiology that we were talking about. But they by far don't encompass what the panel might look like a year from now. In fact, I can share with you our development group as we were looking on the cardiovascular panel, which has 9 or 10 SNPs, and each of those SNPs might actually have several loci or locations across the genome that might be simultaneously being measured. That number is twice as large as it was when the development group actually specified the initial panel. And as we go to our release of this panel just 4 short months after we were performing it for the first time, have already begun to find additional SNPs that are added. So it's a growing field, and it's extremely exciting to be on the forefront of it. We continue to test the viability of our model of looking at those SNPs that are prevalent, relevant, modifiable, and measurable, and find that, at least to date, it has tested to be a really good gold standard to hold the numerous articles that we find every day up against and see if it fits that particular standard. And we're really happy to be finding additional SNPs every day that are bringing more clinical relevance to these profiles.
I'm going to try to use the question that may be on the minds of many of our listeners, and that is, this sounds very exciting, sounds like it's frontier level, but what's it really going to deliver to me, the doc, in helping me to be more successful in managing the complex patient?
And that probably is the greatest win, I believe, in the area of predictive, and if I could use the word functional genomics in a little different way than it's normally expressed. Most of the world is looking at the outcome of the Human Genome Project and trying to answer some age-old question, you know, is disease locked in the genes, or is disease somehow locked in environmental influence? And we might look back on the last half of the last century and realize that we, in public health and in medicine in general, made the greatest strides in appreciation for the environment, which would include a patient's lifestyle and what they ate and the type of nutrients that they consumed. Many people are looking at the results of the Human Genome Project with a bit of a jaundiced eye, saying, wow, we had hoped that we would find the opposite, that almost every human disease had a definable locus or a definable place on the genome that we could look at and identify and maybe get in there eventually and genetically modify and cure diseases once and for all. And we're finding out, much to the chagrin of many researchers, that the answer actually isn't simpler, it's a bit more complex. But we find out now that the end result of a patient's health expression is this complex interplay between genes and the environment. And what predictive genomics does is offer doctors who are embracing the complex patients a new set of tools, an entirely new perspective by which to expand their vision of a patient's genomic risk, to uncover, if you will, a greater understanding of the predecessors that led a patient to the point in time that their health expression exists, to actually look at those antecedents as a series of programmable errors in their genome that might be expressing themselves at this point in time. It literally helps practitioners to narrow not only their diagnostic vision, but actually to get very, very precise relative to therapeutics and be able to tell a patient with a greater degree of certainty than ever before, these are nice to-dos, and these fall into a completely different category of have-to-dos. We all have a series of health recommendations we could make to patients. If patients did everything that we recommended, they wouldn't have time for work or for play. They would simply be taking pills, taking care of themselves, worrying about their sleep, worrying about their spiritual nature, and doing everything that we told them to do. But not everything that we recommend is really appropriate for every individual. So as opposed to practicing medicine for the mean, looking at large epidemiologic studies and saying, you know, for the average person, if you're lucky enough to fit in the center of the curve, this is going to be a nice thing for you to take. The results of these predictive genomic tests actually help to narrow for a patient a preventive plan, a plan for intervention well before the expression of disease or well before the expression of a phenotype, a very narrow set of have-to-dos, that there are higher risk factors for them and therefore some more important preventive measures that they can take that help to narrow for them the important elements in a doctor's recommendation plan for which they really need to cling to for the rest of their lives. And as a result, we're hearing back from clients implementing predictive genomics that their level of compliance relative to patient instructions, lifestyle interventions, nutrition, dietary changes is higher than they've seen with any other form of testing and, in fact, with any other form of communication that they've had before.
This is very exciting because this is the birthing of application, really, of personalized medicine, which is what we've been speaking to through the biochemical individuality concept for, since Roger Williams 50 years ago. So a very beautiful step forward. In the last few minutes we have, could you just quickly summarize how a doctor would just take one of the panels as an example, how they would actually collect the sample and what kind of information they might get back from the laboratory?
I sure will, and a great one is the cardiogenomic panel. All of the panels are just simply evaluating DNA, and DNA can come from a variety of sources. The panels can be performed on either a blood draw, and at that point, of course, we're looking at the buffy coat, which is the resident material of the DNA, or it can be done with a buccal wash, a simple mouth rinse procedure that a patient rinses some alcohol-based mouthwash in their mouth for two successive mornings in a row and spits it back into a sterile collection tube. We actually collect more DNA from a buccal rinse than we do off of the buffy coat. Because DNA is DNA, both are viable solutions for the collection of the DNA, and it really depends upon not only doctor preference, but compliance issues. Some doctors actually like to have the blood draw performed at the moment they've introduced this concept to a patient to assure that it'll be done. Others have preferred, because of biohazard complications and OSHA regulations, to not do blood draws in their offices. So either is fine. It's sent to the laboratory. The DNA is remarkably stable, and we perform analysis at that point that breaks down SNPs into functional areas. We've all been introduced in the area of functional testing to panels of tests that collect analytes into functional groupings. In the area of the cardiogenomic panel, we actually look at polymorphisms that fall into four basic categories. We look at polymorphisms that have an effect or can control the expression of cholesterol metabolism. We look at the ApoE polymorphism that you've been so kind as to educate us about for years and years and years. We look at selectin and cholesterol ester transferase protein. We're also looking at methylation defects as a second category, and to look at the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase regulation gene as a possible error in folate metabolism, and therefore of having as a possible sequelae a methylation defect as an inborn defect, is a very, very interesting area. The third general classification of SNPs involves hypertension. We're looking at GNB3 and angiotensin receptor and angiotensin controlling areas that have predominant control over the mechanisms in the body for primary and essential hypertension. And lastly, we look at the potential for coagulation defects as an error in the regulatory mechanisms for factor 2 and factor 5. Both of these as clotting mechanisms have been well defined. We find these particularly useful as demonstrating genes for accelerated risk, especially for women that are taking oral contraceptives, and in fact for any individual who might have as a part of their consideration in working with their clinician the possibility that Michael Schmidt's blood sludge theory might actually be a key factor in the etiology for atherogenesis. So together these perform an overview of some of the key factors that lead up to not only atherosclerosis but hypertension and as a result stroke, and can give clinicians an ability to look at patients through a broader lens, if you will, and help to look back into their health history, actually back all the way to their genes, and try to draw conclusions effectively for the health intervention and monitoring of these patients. As with all of our tests, the description of each of these SNPs as well as some possible considerations for intervention are included in the report that goes to the clinician. And many clinicians find this helpful, as this is a new and burgeoning field, to have some reference material present in the report itself so they can orient themselves on a regular basis and help to orient their patients on the importance of these SNPs and the specific interventions that are appropriate for patients.
Well, Dr. Rackman, I want to thank you. That was an eloquent discussion and certainly opens up the door for the next step in what I think is the quantification of functional medicine. Thank you, and the best of luck with Genovations, and I'm sure we'll be checking back in to find out the evolution of this program.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. The second laboratory that we're going to have to discuss the role of the clinical laboratory in functional medicine is Metametrics Laboratory, and its founder and president, Dr. Alexander Brawley, is a longstanding friend and colleague and really one of the founding fathers of the functional medicine movement. It's with great privilege we introduce you, Andy, to our Functional Medicine Update listeners, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about how Metametrics Laboratory sees the functional medicine doctor's needs from the clinical laboratory perspective.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here. Metametrics has been specializing in metabolic and nutritional testing for about 20 years. We've helped design some of the basic tests that are used in the functional medicine approach. It's been an interesting experience over that time because, as you know, a lot of this material has not been taught in medical schools, so it's been a challenge for us to get the information out and to relate to it in specific ways to our clinicians that use us. It's always been fascinating for me to see the difference in the types of testing that are done from the allopathic point of view versus the nutritional functional medicine approach. To a great extent, our tests are not really designed to diagnose a specific disease as many other tests are that doctors have available to them, which is kind of a different approach in and of itself. What we do is look at nutritional and metabolic and toxicological imbalances that can relate to a variety of symptoms and disorders that the doctor's seen in his office. And with that information, the clinician can design a particular metabolic approach, nutritional approach, functional medicine approach to help treat the specific patient's needs. And this has kind of evolved into an interesting concept over the years. When we first started the laboratory, it was interesting to see the interest and need to begin to pair specific disease types to specific metabolic nutritional profiles. For example, what does an autistic nutritional profile look like, or a metabolic profile? What is uniquely true about autistic metabolism that might relate to the tests that we're picking up? Is there a pattern there? Is the chronic fatigue patient, which we, as you remember, have done a lot of work with, are there specific patterns in CFS patients or fibromyalgia patients or inflammatory bowel diseases? And for years we've looked for those types of markers, and in some cases you do see them. But more interestingly to me is the experience that we began to realize over time is that we're not really looking at a disease process itself. What we're looking at is the expression of the person's unique genetic makeup that takes a specific imbalance or set of imbalances and expresses them in their own unique ways, which basically means that if, say, we do a panel of tests of amino acids, organic acids, fatty acids, vitamins, minerals, toxic metals, a person can have very similar imbalances. Two people can have very similar imbalances in those measures and yet express those imbalances in entirely different ways. One person can be very depressed with inflammatory bowel disease. Another person can have a skin condition, and yet the imbalances can be very similar. So we really can't diagnose a disease. We're really diagnosing specific metabolic, nutritional imbalances, toxicological imbalances that can relate to a patient's symptoms.
When a physician first comes to you as a novitiate, say, in functional medicine, and they speak with you about how they get started, asking the right questions about the metabolic status of their patients to try to address some of these complex symptom clusters, how do you instruct them? I know you've just authored with Dr. Richard Lord a wonderful book on the use of the clinical laboratory and predictive testing in functional medicine, which I highly recommend. But how do you capture this in sound bites to get a doctor to take that first step?
That's a very good question, and we're seeing more and more doctors getting very interested in this area. The book has been very useful because for years our clients have been asking us, where is this written down? Where can we study this more? And there really has been no real textbook available to talk about functional lab testing. the book is very useful in that sense, in terms of having 1,500 references from the medical literature available to explain and clarify the different tests and how they're used clinically. That's a very useful tool now that we can give to a doctor that calls and wants to use this type of testing. Often we recommend a few basic tests that provide a lot of very useful information in a cost-effective way. There are three tests that we usually recommend for a clinician to get started. They basically are an IgG food antibody assay, fasting plasma amino acid testing, and organic acid analysis. And those three panels provide a wealth of information with very practical, usable therapeutic advice to treat a variety of different symptoms.
With regard to the book, you might say where it is available.
Fine. It's available on our website, metametrics.com, or they can call the office and order it.
We highly recommend it as reading for anyone who wants to be a skilled practitioner in the functional medicine space. Great. So let me go back to the three tests that you recommended as kind of the frontier test, the foundation test, the IgG test, the amino acid analysis, and the urinary organic acid analysis. There are those individuals who might say, wow, you get so much information in these tests that you went from too little information with traditional pathology testing to information glut and overload, and it's like drinking out of a fire hose. How do you help the doctor to distill down this tremendous amount of information that you derive from those three tests into the clinically meaningful clusters?
Well, two basic ways. First of all, there's always been a challenge for us since these are new tests and people have to learn new terminology and words and drag up their biochemistry from medical schools. We have interpretive guides that come with every test that gives very specific recommendations based upon the test result. Food allergy testing is rather easy to deal with in terms of elimination, rotation of the foods that are elevating immunological response in terms of the IgG response. Amino acid analysis, we're primarily looking there at deficiencies of the essential amino acids, and we've actually developed an algorithm that recommends a specific essential amino acid formula based upon the person's unique perceived needs from the test. So that's a very easy way to utilize that test as a therapeutic tool. The organic acid analysis is a bit more complicated. It looks at both nutritional metabolic imbalances as well as dysbiosis markers, things that appear in the urine that are being made from dysbiotic organisms growing in the gut and elsewhere that do show up in the urine and act as little metabolic monkey wrenches, if you will. But we have a very detailed interpretive guide, supplement recommendation, therapeutic recommendations that come with that. In addition, we do have doctorate-level consultants available here for free consultations, and they spend basically most of their time talking with our clients, discussing patients, discussing test results, and helping them with the therapeutic approach to each patient. We try to offer a full range of services that make it very easy for the clinician to utilize these tests and apply them in practice.
So let me go from that, which is the more specific, to the more philosophical question. You spoke about the difference between a diagnostic test that arrives at a specific ICD-9 diagnostic code versus a prognostic test that evaluates the functional capability of the individual and their trajectory towards a disease or their functional status. We all know that the tilt in the healthcare reimbursement system over the last 30 years has certainly been on the diagnostic side, not on the prognostic side. How does a doctor, within the guise of the powers that be in our third-party reimbursement system in the system of today, handle this prognosis versus diagnosis dialectic?
Well, that's a very interesting and challenging question, and I'm not quite sure I know the answer to that. A lot of the doctors that we work with basically work as a cash business practice. They do provide detailed receipts. We also provide detailed receipts to send to their insurance companies for reimbursement. And in many cases, they do get reimbursed with proper diagnostic coding and CPT code. It's starting to happen, and I think this is becoming more and more acceptable approach as time comes. The director of Medicare here in Georgia has told us, even though they don't reimburse for tests they consider to be research and or investigational, or screening, that views our tests as really the wave of the future that the Medicare will eventually have to be reimbursing for.
Well, that's
because it is very cost-effective.
That's very exciting and very much in support of what we've been speaking to on Functional Medicine Update all these many years, so that's very encouraging. When you look at the kind of patients that are the most common clusters that the laboratory is providing information to the clinician about. You talked about chronic fatigue and autism and irritable bowel. Are there certain kinds of system difficulties that are more commonly engaged in this kind of testing?
It's really remarkable the wide range of different types of symptoms we're seeing, from significant inborn errors of metabolism like Down syndrome patients. Children benefit from this type of testing and nutritional intervention, to mostly chronic diseases, primarily where the modern medical system has failed to produce an effective treatment for them. All types of things, from mental emotional disorders to skin conditions, inflammatory bowel disease, joint problems, the fatigue and pain issues. It's constantly amazed me the wide variety of different types of patients we deal with over time.
And would you say that in general the laboratory provides services more in the chronic versus the acute disease management area? I would assume that would be the case.
In most cases, that's correct.
I know from articles that we've seen appear in the New England Journal of Medicine and presentations we've had by experts at our International Symposium on Functional Medicine, it appears as if the chronic disease management system in America, probably the developed world, is far lagging behind the acute disease management system. So it appears as if Metametrics Laboratory is a pioneer in developing new approaches towards the recognition of the origin of mechanisms underlying and hopefully the remediation of chronic illness.
Yes, we've been very active in developing new technologies for measuring the various components we're interested in, and constantly on the lookout in the medical literature for new things to be looking at and how they relate to chronic illnesses. Last year, we started a joint venture with two other physicians here in town to do molecular genetic testing, and started Horizon Molecular Medicine Laboratory here at Metametrics as kind of a division of Metametrics. And it's really interesting because we're now testing the entire spectrum of disease, from severe inborn error of metabolism to the chronic illness model, where what you're looking at is not a severe inborn error of metabolism, but weaknesses in the genetic structure that simply take longer to express themselves. They're not expressing themselves in the first months of life, but they're starting to express themselves in combination with environmental factors as we age. So we have the ability now to look at the entire spectrum of disease processes, from very acute, severe genetic disorders to the more difficult ones to deal with. You know, why is a person getting sick and they don't know why?
Well, I want to compliment you. In the years that you have been involved with the clinical laboratory business, now 20 years, you have been really a pioneer in opening up tools for the doctor to not just speak about functionality, but to actually be able to measure it and then to do something about it. So my strongest support and appreciation for the work you've done, and obviously your book will be listed on the back of the summary cards of this month's issue for those that want to follow up, and I recommend it highly.
I appreciate that, Jeff, and I would also like to thank you because, as you know, you were very instrumental in getting me to start down this crazy, wonderful pathway here way back when, so I appreciate what you've been doing too.
Well, thank you, and the best of luck, and we'll be back in touch with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Brawley.
Thanks, Jeff.
Following our theme of the clinical laboratory in functional medicine, we're very privileged to have as our third representative of the laboratory activities within our field, Daryl Hickok, who is the president of Doctors Data, one of the primary pioneering laboratories in the area of the functional medicine assessment. Daryl has been involved in this field for many years, and the laboratory goes back more than 20 years with its pioneering work initially in essential trace mineral assessment and in toxic mineral evaluation, two areas that often I think get overlooked by the clinician as valuable as they really are. So with that in mind, Daryl, I'd like to welcome you to a functional medicine update. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the history of Doctors Data and the development of the essential trace element evaluation and the toxic mineral evaluation.
Thank you, Dr. Bland. Actually, this is our 30th year that we're celebrating in 2002. In 1972, we started hair trace metal analysis, which was quite revolutionary for the time. The theory behind that was that we wanted to look at the exposure and excretion of chronic levels of metals as opposed to the acute levels that you would find in the blood. We've added many different matrices to our testing menu since that time. Urine analysis, which is primarily used for chelation and provocation testing. Whole blood, RBC, mineral levels, which look at circulating levels of metals and intracellular levels of metals. And our latest addition is the fecal metals test, which is a marker for oral exposure and biliary excretion of metals. This has proved to be quite popular in the autism market. That is really the basic functions of our laboratory. We've since been moving into the microbiology, parasitology, amino acid market.
You mentioned a word which I think is very important that differentiates some of the things that the clinical laboratory does in the functional medicine evaluation versus pathology, and that is provocation testing. And for many of our listeners, they may not have picked up that point of differentiation, which I think is quite important. A provocation testing related to a challenge of a patient with a specific substance and then looking at the response to that challenge. This would be like the difference between an oral glucose tolerance test, for instance, versus a fasting blood glucose, or the difference between an exercise EKG versus a resting electrocardiogram, where you're actually putting the system through some demand and looking at its resiliency. This characterizes some of the points of differentiation of a functional medicine assessment versus a pathology assessment. Could you tell us a little bit about provocation testing as it relates to the minerals for those who may not be familiar with that?
Absolutely. The basic technique involves the collection of a baseline urine sample, which is usually done between 6 and 24-hour collections, depending on the agent to be used. This provides the baseline for the differentiation. The next step would involve the administration of a provoking, challenging, or chelating agent, depending on the pharmacokinetics of the agent, such as DMPS, DMSA, even vitamin C has been used in fecal metal provocations, but primarily it's a urine test. The agent is administered at appropriate dosage, and then a second urine collection is taken for a period of time that's based on the half-life of the chelating or provoking agent. Then the two are compared, and the differentiation provides insight into the patient's metal exposure, body burden, and total load.
I know that Doctors Data has been a very important educator and leader in the field of heavy metal toxicity, not just mercury, but lead and cadmium, arsenic as a metalloid, aluminum. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience that you've gotten, which over the 30 years has been massive in helping to understand the importance of this problem? Because I think it's still not understood at the level it should be in many doctors' backgrounds.
I believe that the environmental exposure has been increasing over the years to heavy metals, as we know, cadmium, lead, mercury, and even more esoteric metals that are being used today. They have more of a limited occupational exposure. There was an article that was published in Circulation that linked the levels of mercury to certain cardiovascular diseases, cardiomyopathies. It was thousands of times higher levels of mercury in patients with this disorder as compared to patients without. More and more research is bring the prominence of metals in underlying causes of disease and organ damage and learning disorders. And as the field continues to grow and expand, I'm certain that we'll see that metals as the elemental cause of some of these problems that arise will gain greater and greater light.
When I look back historically in my nearly 30 years experience in this field, I recognize the number of samples that you have processed at Doctors Data and the information database you have is probably second to none in this area. It probably encompasses hundreds of thousands of samples. As you look at that, are there certain patterns that have emerged from your understanding that connect some of these body burdens of minerals to certain clinical chronic conditions?
We do have a very extensive database, and there are interesting patterns that develop. Most of the patterns that we see tend to be geographical in where the patient lives. It truly reflects the old idiom that you are what you eat. In Japan, for example, we see much, much higher levels of mercury than we do in the U.S. population, and coastal people in the U.S. have higher levels of mercury and arsenic than do those that live in the Midwest or the breadbasket portions of the state. It's very intriguing, and it's been a source of much debate among our company scientists here, whether or not there should be a reference range that takes into account the dietary factors, that is, a higher level of mercury may be normal or acceptable for a person in Japan than would be for a person living in Iowa. It's a debate that goes on in traditional medicine and in all aspects of medicine to try to determine what a true reference population is.
When a doctor first comes to your laboratory starting into the use of services related to assessing function, your technical staff undoubtedly has conversations with that doctor, kind of guiding them towards what might be the most cost-effective test to start off with a patient who may express chronic illness. Do you have some basic starting guidelines as to how a physician is instructed to move into this testing, which may differ from that which you're familiar with in the pathology area?
Well, we really break down our testing business into three main areas. One is the gastrointestinal testing. The other would be the metal testing, the provocation, and also then we have several tests that are nutritional status-oriented. Depending on which area of interest the doctor is focused, for gastrointestinal, we would recommend that they start out with a comprehensive stool analysis. This is a three-day collection that looks at bacterial cultures, yeast cultures, and chemistry markers of significance to the gut, immunology markers and fat markers and things of that nature. In the nutritional arena, we offer amino acid analysis, which is a very comprehensive test that breaks down amino acids as they relate to certain conditions such as gastrointestinal function. Again, it ties back in immunology, neurological markers, detoxification markers, and at the end of that test, we provide sort of a summary of conditions one might expect based on the results. Also, we offer liver function tests that are functional markers of xenobiotic exposure and excretion. And we're working on developing a protein load test that's based on amino acids so you can determine the patient's ability to process protein.
Well, that's fascinating. So there would be a good example of a provocative challenge test where you're actually looking at the reserves of protein splitting enzymes and transport processes of amino acids across the GI. So you'd actually be looking at a whole range of functional aspects by the provocation technique. That's a very interesting idea.
Absolutely. We've been working on this for some time and feel that we're very close to offering this test. We've been doing some internal studies and it's very exciting.
What do you see the future looking like from your perspective as it pertains to the use of the clinical laboratory in the functional assessment area?
As the industry develops, there's more and more markers that are available, and detection limits become lower and more precise. And it just allows us to measure things that 10, 20 years ago the technology wouldn't allow us to measure. It's a broad horizon. There's lots of interesting technologies out there. We've been looking, again, back at protein from the genetic aspect. We feel that genetic testing, where you determine if a person has a number of known genetic defects, is a very interesting possibility. But when you apply the environmental exposure, that expresses itself as proteins. If you can measure those proteins, then you have a deeper level of understanding of what's going on with that patient than you do if you merely measure the gene defect.
That's very interesting. So that's really the difference between what might be called the genomics versus proteomics model, looking more at how the genes got expressed ultimately into proteins and how those proteins ultimately function as enzymes or structural components of the cell or signaling molecules.
It's absolutely correct. It's possible for a person to have 2 of 13 genetic defects, but without the environmental influence, it wouldn't express itself into the potential disease or condition.
Well, I want to personally congratulate both you and all of the Doctors Data Group for your 30th anniversary. That's quite an accomplishment and an achievement in and of itself, and for being a pioneer through these 30 years in the development of this field. It seems to me that doctors who are starting down the road into functional medicine would be well served having a chance to talk with your professional staff as to how they would get started in this laboratory arena.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate you spending the time with us, and we'll be checking back to see how things are progressing here, in that it's clearly obvious we need to do more of the clinical assessment evaluation for our listeners in Functional Medicine Update.
Certainly. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Daryl.
We were very fortunate to have three leaders in the clinical laboratory area in functional medicine provide to us their opinions and perspective as it relates to how the laboratory can be useful in helping to manage the complex patient. I'm once again reminded, as I started off this month's Functional Medicine Update, to the focus of the issue of Science Magazine, April 26, 2002, on the puzzle of complex diseases, that we're just emerging a new form of medicine that is built on mechanistic understanding of the origin of disease and moving away from just a pathognomonic definition of disease, so that ultimately what we will have is the ability to manage chronic illness at its level of cause rather than its level of effect early on. It's unusual to me that it has taken so long for the reimbursement patterns to catch up with this increasing technology. We certainly see an unbelievable depth of technology, science, and biomedical understanding about functionality and the use of various tests for evaluating functional status of the individual. What we have not caught up with yet is translation of that into the third-party reimbursement programs, which are still focused on pathophysiology at the exclusion of functionality. I believe that this has to change from an economic driver, if not from a humanistic perspective, because of the cost and effectiveness of trying to treat aging populations of baby boomers with treatments that only modify the effect and not the cause. So therefore, I believe what we heard from our three leaders in the clinical laboratory field in functional medicine was a presaging of the dawn which is near to come, if for no other reason for economic efficiency, if not for humanistic and compassionate reasons. In the meantime, I wish all of us who are in this field the strongest of support and the toughness of spirit to will out through this transition, as the emperor is being seen more frequently to have no clothes and that the new form of medicine is emerging.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.